yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yes, yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today the topic is, the main topic, what's happening in Argentina and the rest of the emerging markets, I might say. We got a big shift going on, similar to what happened, almost happened in 2013, you know, when we had the so-called taper tantrum, as they called it, as the U.S. signaled it was going to raise interest rates, which led to an immediate sell-off of foreign currencies, trying to convert them into dollars before they depreciated. Capital flight, it's called. And when you have capital flight, what that means when your currency is devaluing is that the central banks raise interest rates to try to stop the capital flight in these emerging markets. And when that happens, of course, interest rates rise. And when that happens, slows down their economy. And at the same time, because it devalues their currency, raises import inflation, import cost inflation. So it's a double whammy. Slows down the real economy and raises prices. And that's all because of the U.S. dollar rising. In 13, they just threatened to do that. And there was a tantrum in the emerging markets, you might, as they called it, taper tantrum, tapering U.S. Interest rates. And the central bank, U.S. central bank, had to back off. Because if they continued, it would not only cause a crisis in emerging markets, it would cause problems for U.S. multinational corporations doing business in those markets. You know, if they're making a lot of profits offshore, which they are, they're making it in the local currency. And if they have to take those profits in the local currency and convert them back to dollars, they lose profits on paper. So U.S. multinationals didn't like that either. And they put pressure on the Obama administration, you know, to get the central bank to back off of this. Don't raise interest rates, because interest rate hikes have the direct result of pulling up the value of the U.S. dollar. You see how these things are connected? Yes. Okay, so looks like we're having a renewal of that event in 2013, although this time it's real. It's not a threat of the U.S. central bank to raise interest rates and push the dollar up. It's an actual fact. Interest rates are now rising, and so is the dollar. As the dollar rises, the Argentinian peso and the Turkish lira decline. As that happens, investors, U.S. and in those countries, try to convert their currency, their local currency, into dollars. Well, that demand drives up the value of the dollar even more and depresses the value of their own currencies even more. And if their currencies get depreciated, well, then the cost of imports rise, inflation rises. So to try to stop it all, they raise interest rates to stop the capital flight, in other words. And when they do that, their domestic economy, the real economy, slows down dramatically. We're on the cusp of that happening again. Another emerging markets crisis is just emerging. Here, just in the past month, you know, when all the focus and attention was on Trump and his trade offensive, as what I've been talking about, and we'll talk about that a little bit more shortly, particularly the China-U.S. trade, you know, while all that focus was going on, at the same time, the real crisis was beginning in emerging markets and will continue. Unless, of course, the Fed slows down its rate hikes. I think that's going to happen. Both because the rate hikes are already taking a toll on certain sectors of the U.S. economy. You can see U.S. autos, you can see U.S. construction already. And I don't believe they're going to be able to follow through without precipitating another recession in 2019. As I've said many times, the Fed cannot raise interest rates, its benchmark federal funds rate, more than 2.5% from its current 1.75. You know, that's less than 1% more. If it does, it's going to precipitate a recession in the U.S., an old-fashioned normal recession, not like 2008, which was precipitated by financial crash. You know, you got to distinguish between normal recessions, which have to do with policy shifts or just the, you know, long end of the business cycle, running out of steam, or what I call epic recessions, in my 2010 book, which are precipitated by financial crashes like 2008-9 and, of course, 1929-30. Not all recessions and depressions are the same. You know, that's the problem with mainstream economics. It thinks they're all the same. They think that depressions are just recessions writ large. No, they're qualitatively different. And so are epic recessions. Epic recessions are like a hybrid. They have the characteristics of a normal recession and of a depression. And they can go either way. They can fall back into a normal recession, or they can transform into a depression. Well, we've had epic recessions before. In 1907-9, we had a crash, financial crash, right? And the Treasury bailed out the banks, and we entered into a 6-year-long period of stagnation. Epic recessions are followed by the real economy going through a short, shallow recovery and short, shallow declines for an extended period of time following the financial crash. Well, that was 2009 to 14, only ended with World War I. And we had the same thing, 1929 to 30. You know, it started out as an epic recession. It was only affecting, you know, normally the auto industry, manufacturing, construction, not the whole economy. But the banking crashes, four of them that followed in 1930, 31, 32, 33, drove it into a bona fide depression. And what about 2008? Well, we had a big financial crash, a banking crash in 2008. But the Fed bailed out the banks, pumped in $6-7 trillion with quantitative easing, and bailed them out. But what followed was not further banking crashes like in 30, 34. What we had was stagnant growth, short, shallow recoveries, and short, shallow declines again. In Europe, we had the double dip recession, 2012 to 13, 14. Same thing in Japan at the same time. The U.S., I believe, had a double dip recession, but because of the way we changed the definition conveniently in 2013, timing, you know, appropriate, we ended up with just no growth, a little bit of a decline in 1 year, one quarter at the end of 2012, when Europe and Japan fell into recession, followed by a flat no growth in the following quarter. But if you did not change the definition of GDP, which the U.S. did, we would have had two consecutive quarters of clear decline, a mild recession in 2012-13, like Europe and Japan. So everybody in the capitalist advanced economies slipped into a double dip in 2012-13. All right, so that's what we've gone through since then is stagnant real growth. Only now, the animal spirits being released with a 30% boost to their profits by the Trump tax cuts. Only now are we getting a little bit of a more recovery. But from 2009 to 2016, it was clearly stagnant recovery, especially in Europe and Japan, but a little less so here in the U.S. U.S. always comes off a little less in its decline because it controls the global dollar and it makes other countries and economies pay, and it props itself up because it controls the dollar, an international currency, you see. Okay, so that's a little bit of economic history and the difference between normal recessions, epic recessions, and bona fide depressions, and where the latest event here falls in that scenario. The problem with mainstream economics is it can't distinguish between the different types of causes, the different types of contractions. According to mainstream economics, depressions are just recessions writ large, and there's no distinction about an epic recession hybrid that has characteristics of both. And but they call the latest one the Great Recession, you see, to distinguish it from normal recessions, the 10 we had in the U.S. before 2008, normal recessions due to policy errors and or just investment petering out after a period of time, right? They call that a Great Recession, Paul Krugman, right? Well, I took issue with Paul. I said, Paul, you call it great. Well, qualitatively, what's different about a great compared to a normal? They have no description of what's different qualitatively, you see. They just call it the great, a little bit more than a normal, not as bad as a depression. Well, that's nonsense. That's not analysis. Okay, so continuing here. Where are we with this emerging market crisis? Well, we're going to get back to that, focusing on Argentina. But first, I want to talk a little bit about some wrap-ups here for some previous shows recently and developments. I've always argued that stock buybacks and dividend payouts have enriched the investor class and businesses, corporations, the 1%. Significantly since 2009, while the rest of us stagnated. Stock buybacks. And in previous shows, I've been talking about the fact that stock buybacks and dividend payouts since 2010 have been $1 trillion a year. And then in the last show, I think I mentioned that now those stock buybacks are accelerating more than $1 trillion a year. Goldman Sachs forecasted is going to be 1.2 trillion this year. I think it's going to be closer to 1.3 or 4 trillion. So, yes, stock buybacks. What's driving stock buybacks? Well, in the first quarter of 2018, already, just the S&P 500 corporations have bought back $158 billion of their stock. That's just S&P 500. If you add other corporations, at least another $50 billion. So we got a $200 billion stock buyback just for the first 3 years. And Apple has announced $100 billion itself alone, and all the rest are following suit. And you're going to continue to have at least $400 billion a year in dividend payouts this year. So we're running stock buybacks at about $800 billion a year. And dividend dividend payouts, $400 billion to $500 billion. So we're already $1.3 trillion in buybacks and dividend payouts forecasted for this year. Okay, so why is that happening, and what's the consequence of that? Well, it's keeping the stock market up, isn't it? Yeah, stock buybacks drive up the demand for stock prices, drive stock prices up. Dividend payouts to investors, they recycle it back into the stock market, lots of it. M&A, mergers and acquisitions, now at record level as well. That drives up the price of stocks. And you got 85% of all the stock purchases and sales are done by institutional investors. And they're the ones who are gaining from this. And the 15% retail investors, average folks here, have just tied themselves to that wagon by purchasing exchange-traded funds and passive investing, just going along with the momentum. And of course, what's also driving it is not just the stock buybacks and dividend payouts and M&A, but the Trump tax cuts that are coming back from offshore, the $2 trillion held offshore, big tax cut to bring some of that money back. That $2 trillion, and I would say at least $500 billion of that's going into the stock market as well, and into M&A. You know, these big corporations, the tech, the energy, the bankers, and the pharmaceuticals, they're the biggies who have been abusing keeping their profits offshore and not paying taxes. You know, now they get a big deal to bring it back, just as they did in 2005, same deal. But now the numbers are even greater. So it's all flowing into the stock market. And that's why whenever the stock market tries to correct, you know, it corrects 5% or so, and it should have long ago. Here's all this money on the sideline, runs right back in. Institutional investors, you know, push it right back in, drive that price back up. You know, slowly it's slipping, but, you know, that's why we haven't had a major 20% correction yet, but we will. Question is only when, but not right now, not this year, because you got all this money flowing in from the Trump tax cuts, you know, pushing the bottom line profitability of corporations 20 to 30% overnight. You know, all that money is being then pushed on into buybacks and dividend payouts and acquiring and merging with competitors, and that's keeping the stock market up. Right, which will continue. Okay, so, you know, just a wrap up on that with the latest data of about $200 billion just in buybacks alone in the first quarter of this year. Another interesting development here is bonds. What's happening with bonds, not just the stock market? Well, the important thing about bonds is twofold. One, bond issuance has also been $1 trillion a year. Investors buying bonds, not just buying stocks, $1 trillion a year. And the second important thing about it is the quality of the bonds being issued is rapidly deteriorating in quality. The quality is declining rapidly. Well, what do I mean by that? Well, there's two kinds of bonds. One's called investment grade, which is high quality companies. In other words, they're not near you know, financial problems. You know, they're paying their interest and dividends and so forth. The companies are sound and so forth, right? And then there's what's called junk bonds. In other words, companies whose balance sheets are not very good and they're on shaky grounds and probably will default in the future. So when they issue their bonds, they have to issue at higher interest rates, junk bonds, they call them, high yield junk bonds. Right? Okay, so if you look at the issuance of bonds in 2008, 1.8 trillion was investment grade. Now in 2018, that issuance is going to be 3.2 trillion. So almost doubling the issuing of bonds. Bonds are debt, you see, and debt means when the next crisis comes and companies don't have as much income because the price of their products does not grow and or the sales decline, they don't have as much income on hand to pay the principal and interest of the debt. Well, the more debt they have, the harder it's going to be with declining income to pay the principal and interest. Then they're in trouble, you see. Then they have to go and borrow more money. Well, if they're a established company and, you know, good balance sheet, the banks will loan them more money to roll over their old debt that comes due. But if they're not such a good bet, the banks won't roll over their debt. And then a company that's up to its ears in high interest rate junk debt is facing Armageddon and default, which means failure to pay the principal or interest on their old debt, and therefore they can be declared bankrupt, default. Okay, junk bond debt rose from 800 billion to 1.3 trillion over the last decade. Investment grade 1.8 to 3.2. All right, so the real problem with bonds is what's called triple B rated bonds. That's the lowest quality of investment grade bonds. It's almost junk and really should be considered junk. How much has that grown since 2008? Well, according to Morgan Stanley, 700 billion in triple B rated poor quality investment grade bonds in 2008 was issued. In 2018, $2.5 trillion will be issued in junk, near junk, triple B rated corporate bonds. That's ominous. That's ominous. It's not just junk bonds, but it's also triple B rated bonds, even more so. Morgan Stanley recently reported that almost 30% of all the US bonds are junk. That includes triple B. 31 out of every three bonds that's been issued is junk. That means when the recession comes and asset prices collapse and sales of goods slow down, and therefore their price appreciation slows down or even declines, right? Businesses, this one out of three almost businesses out there that's loaded itself up on junk debt is going to have big problems rolling it over. And if they can't roll it over, which means they won't get loans because they'll look too weak, you know, and look like they won't survive the next recession, then they will go under. Watch for the retail sector. That's where you're going to see the weakest over-indebted companies. And I mean some big companies like Sears, JCPenney. We're already seeing it hitting other areas of retail, you know, like the toy stores and so forth. Retail is going to be in big trouble. And of course, retail is getting whacked from the other side from Amazon, right? Amazon is already, before a recession, knocking the pedestal out of retail, traditional retail here, and causing their revenue to decline and their prices not to grow, and they can't recover. So they're already being softened up by Amazon. And when the next recession comes, which I predict is 2019, watch these department store bonds. When they've loaded up on junk to try to stay afloat, you see, that's part of the problem. They're loaded with junk. And so is certain sectors of the energy sector, right? You know, once you get a big name company, you know, like Sears or something, and a couple of them going under, it puts the fear of God in investors, and they all pull out from companies that maybe might have survived, but now they don't. And then you see contagion effects across companies and across industries. Okay, I think this is, you know, this triple B junk bond problem could be the heart of a next financial crisis. You know, we had a similar bond crisis back in 1987, 88, junk bonds and contraction and bailouts and so forth. I think, you know, that's under radar once again. Okay, so that's my comment wrap up on bonds. Let's talk about trade. What's happening with trade? Well, I just wrote another piece on Trump's trade offensive. It's called Is the US-China Trade War for Real? Go read it on my blog, jackrasmus.com, or you can read it on Counterpunch or Znet or Global Research, etc. It's all on you know, those various blogs where I talk about the China trade war. Is it for real? Or is it a phony trade war, similar to what Trump is doing in his negotiations with NAFTA and South Korea and all the other allies of the US? Excuse me, I'm trying to get over a cold. I wrote a piece, Is the Trade War Phony? That's also on my blog and those other public blogs before, a couple of weeks ago, followed up with this China Trade War for Real. But in the first of the three-part series, I talk about the fact that this Trump trade war, so-called, set off with the steel and aluminum tariffs, is phony. You know, Trump is doing this for domestic political reasons, appealing to his domestic base. And the real capitalist elites running the show will not allow him, if he even is interested in, you know, throwing out NAFTA, scrapping NAFTA, scrapping trade deals and so forth. They're not going to allow him to do that, and he's not doing that. What he wants is just something to show his America First economic nationalist domestic political base that he's doing something about trade. There's a dual track U.S. trade strategy going. One is a phony track, token adjustments for U.S. allies, and on the other hand, a potential trade war with China, quite different. I say potential because that may not work out either. There may be an agreement there. We'll see. Too early to tell. But the rest is phony. You could see the phony trade war emerging with the deal with South Korea, right? South Korea, I think the third largest importer of steel to the U.S., or exporter of steel to the U.S., however you want to describe it, was just totally left off the hook as far as steel imports are concerned. The NAFTA countries, Mexico and Canada, number one and two or one and four largest steel exporters to the U.S. And they've been let off the steel imports hook. Aluminum is the largest exporter. I mean, Canada's the largest exporter of aluminum to the U.S. That's been left off the hook. The NAFTA deal you're going to see is going to be patterned on the template of South Korea, and it will focus mostly on autos and pharmaceuticals. In other words, Trump just wants to get a little token change and adjustment here that he can then exaggerate and lie about to his domestic base, like just as he went to Pittsburgh, talked about steel, big bombast speech, what he was going to do, and then hasn't done anything. He'll do the same thing going to those, maybe Detroit or some other, he won't go to Detroit, but he'll go to some other, maybe Tennessee, the auto companies down there. And he'll make a big speech full of exaggerations, hyperbole, bombast, and lies. That kind of describes the guy, doesn't it? Hyperbole, bombast, and lies, yes. Claiming he's done something in NAFTA and he hasn't. Well, we're going to see pretty soon. Because NAFTA deal's close, and the focus will be autos. 30% of U.S. Exports from Mexico are auto exports. 20% from Canada. But the term they're using now, leaking out, is that it will be a skinny deal, quote unquote, focusing on auto rules. Right, not tariffs, not quotas, but they're talking about requiring Mexico to raise its wages for its auto workers on 40% of the cars. 40% of the cars, that's all, right? How much of a wage, Is that really going to slow down Mexico exports of autos to the U.S.? Nah, that's a cover. That's an excuse. That's an obfuscation, That's a token adjustment where he's gonna exaggerate the significance of it, but it's not gonna slow any auto parts or auto exports from Mexico or Canada to the U.S., right? The other thing he wants out of this adjustment to NAFTA is pharmaceuticals. He wants arrangements and details where the U.S. big pharma can charge as much in Mexico as it charges here in the U.S., right? And then, of course, he wants to improve the tribunals where disputes are resolved in favor, trade disputes are resolved in favor of U.S. corporations. You see, that's what he's after. And that's what you're going to see here. In other words, a South Korea template with token adjustments. All right, we'll see this very close, and I'm sure we'll have a show on it in the not too distant future. So the NAFTA deal is close, but it's another example of phony trade deals. Right. Well, what about the China? What's going on in China? As I said, my article is the U.S.-China trade war real? Question mark. Article. Do read that for more detail of what I'm going to say right now. Okay. what does the U.S. want from China? Well, if you listen and read the press, oh, the U.S. wants to reduce the China trade deficit, which is $337 billion here a year last year. Wants to reduce that. In other words, slow down, or no, not slow down, but roll back China exports to the U.S. and or increase China, open up and increase U.S. Exports to China. Either one. Well, what are U.S. exports? Agricultural stuff and energy exports. That's what the U.S. primarily exports to China, and some consumer stuff. Well, if you read the press, that's the number one objective, and that's what Trump talks about, of the current negotiations with China. But that's not the real objective, you see. The real objectives are U.S. companies, particularly banks, want more access to China. They want to expand in China. Right now, China, well, until recently, China said, you can only go in joint ventures, owning less than 50%. Well, they want to have majority ownership or total ownership. Well, China has already agreed publicly to allow 51% ownership. That's what the banks really want. U.S. bankers, see, they want to get in there, into China, and charge fees and so forth on, making loans and getting involved in the financial markets over there, so forth, as they're beginning to develop further. Access to China markets. But even bigger than that is this thing called technology transfer. Technology transfer is a big issue for the U.S. I'm talking about China transferring U.S. technology by requiring U.S. corporations there to share that technology when they do business there. And then, of course, China gives the technology to all Chinese companies, and the Chinese companies then compete with the American companies, you see. And of course, China companies are trying to buy up companies in the US to acquire them that have the key technology they want. Now, why is it such a concern to the US? It's not just commercial and business concern. The US is concerned because these new technologies, the next generation technologies, are military technologies. What am I talking about? Primarily, I'm talking about technologies like 5G wireless, cybersecurity technologies, and artificial intelligence, AI. China last year issued a strategy paper that it called China 2025, which spelled out that China wants to be the global leader in these three key next-gen technologies. Well, that's got the U.S. kind of concerned, particularly the intelligence agencies and the Pentagon and the Defense Department and defense companies, because all of those three are significant military capability technologies. You see, it's pretty clear a next war is going to be fought with software and technology. This new next gen technologies, or the run up to the next war, will clearly be technological feints and skirmishes and attempts to shut down economies, etc. Testing them, how effective are they? Can they shut down the grid and so on and so forth? That's all going to happen. You see, before you have any kind of exchange, and may nuclear exchange. What a word, huh? Exchange of nuclear. I'll give you my dollar and you give me your bowl of rice. Exchange, no, war, devastating, worst kind. Civilians will be the ones that will be killed, almost virtually all. Anyway, I don't want to get off on that. Let's get back to economics. And of course, it's not unrelated, is it? Technology is clearly related to war capability, and AI, next gen 5G, cybersecurity. The US wants to slow down China. China's strategy document, China 2025, really got their attention last year, you see. And soon as it came out, Trump administration ordered the Office of U.S. Trade to do a study of how China was gathering technology from U.S. corporations in China and from the U.S. Now, that was August of last year. And when the Office of U.S. Trade came out with their report on that study of August 2017, came out in March of this year, within a week, actually within a few days, right, Trump launched his so-called trade offensive against China within days. And everything that they were tasked, that the OUST was tasked to investigate four categories. They came out and said, yeah, China's abusing all four categories and they're getting all this technology from us, right? So the trade war against China was set in motion last year, you see. It's not new. It's not new. And it's really one of the targets of U.S. trade. The three areas of the U.S. trade negotiations that are at stake here. One, reducing the trade deficit and China exports to the U.S. Two, access for U.S. multinational corporations in China. And three, slowing down or thwarting the technology transfer. And if you look at the U.S. trade team, it reflects those three objectives. Who's on the trade team? Well, Steve Mnuchin, Treasury Secretary, ex-CEO or president of Goldman Sachs, right? Shadow banker, right? Running the Treasury. He's representing the bankers on the trade team and U.S. multinational corporations. And actually, he thinks things are going kind of well here. China, even before he sat down with him, said, we'll give you 51% ownership. And China said, and maybe within 3 years, you can buy 100%. Well, that's why Mnuchin said immediately when he went to Beijing here earlier in the month, oh, things are looking good. Yeah, multinationals will take the money. Bankers will take that opportunity. And China knows it. And they're playing him like violin strings. And then, of course, there's the defense establishment in the U.S. Who's representing them on the trade team? Lighthizer, Robert Lighthizer, the trade representative, and Peter Navarro, the John Bolton of economic policy, another China hater, China hardliner here, is also reflecting his special trade advisor to Trump. Reflecting the defense establishment in the U.S. concerned about technology transfer. See, their goal, they want to stop technology transfer. Bankers want more access. What does Trump want? Trump wants some kind of win before November. He wants to show something to his domestic political base that he's doing something America first. The American First groupers, a group, had a big meeting, conference in Washington the beginning of March, and it didn't get much publicity. But this is a coalition of different groups that want a hard line be taken by the U.S. on not just politics, Iran and stuff like that, but economics and trade. And it's not well known, but they pledge to raise $100 million for Trump's reelection, And within 24 hours, Trump then came out with his tariffs on steel and aluminum. Well, you think this is just a coincidence? I don't think so. Anyway, the America Firsters, and economic nationalism, themes that won Trump the election in 2016 in those key states that have been devastated by free trade. He's playing that card again, you see, and he's pumping up all of this economic nationalism and America First stuff. Of course, the immigration and the wall play into that as well. So Trump wants something before the November elections, because if Republicans lose the House, then everything else he has planned and the Republicans is going to be blocked. So part of the purpose here for getting some wins and on trade is domestic political politics and November midterm elections. And by the way, that's also why he's trying to get something out of trade with NAFTA and others that he can trumpet back to his political base. Look what I did. Of course, he'll lie, exaggerate, and so forth, but he'll hold something up, see? And in the meantime, he's going to talk tough with China here, because he's not going to get a settlement with China before November. But he's gonna bash them politically while he's negotiating with him and calling Chinese President Xi his good friend. You see, there's the public bombast and hyperbole and exaggerations and lies. That's for the media that grabs it and runs with it, and that's for the average citizen to read and understand. Oh, he's doing something. He's being tough. But then there's the real negotiations behind the scene, where they're not so tough. Where they're cutting deals. So the question is, will Trump go for something light just to get something that he can trumpet to his base? Well, he's certainly going to get that with NAFTA, South Korea, and Europe negotiations, which also will not conclude before November. But I've always predicted that the capitalist elite, the traditional elite, is not going to let him do anything really dramatic and radical when it comes to trade. And free trade deals. Excuse me. They're going to let him tinker with it and get some changes to their advantage and let him exaggerate it. You see, that's what's going on with trade in general, I think. Back to the China trade, you've got this U.S. trade team with different interests and priorities, and they're split. The bankers really want access, and the defense Pentagon wants technology, and Trump wants something to show, and Larry Kudlow is his domestic politics link there on let's get something to show. That we can, exaggerate to our domestic base. Well, China's playing off these splits very cleverly, you see. Not only, as it already said, you can have a 51% ownership, right? But it's also signaled that we will open up our China market to your auto companies. And the U.S. auto companies really need that, see, because sales are slowing down in the U.S. here. And going to taper off significantly soon. That's a start for them. China has already signaled as well that they're also going to agree to reduce their exports to the U.S. in certain areas to be negotiated. So they're throwing out some incentives here. To the bankers who want access, and to the trade deficit folks who want to show something. But they're holding very firm on the technology transfer, right? They've declared that is non-negotiable, non-negotiable. So we'll see whether Trump takes some gains in access and notable reductions in exports from China. Takes that and runs with it, settles with that instead of technology transfer. We don't know. China's Liu He is in Washington, and negotiating the real deal here, right? As he arrives, Trump declares for his base, "Oh, we want $200 billion of the $337 billion trade deficit cut by China by 2020. $200 billion by 2020." Well, that's nonsense. That's not going to happen, right? The U.S. comes out with this 8-point plan, and the U.S. Gives deep six to China companies' acquisitions here in the U.S. Lately, ZTE Corp. Is one. And China is skirmishing by slowing down U.S. exports into China administratively, right? And China, at the same time, by the way, is opening talks on free trade treaty with Japan and South Korea. So the maneuvering goes on, and the skirmishes go on, and we got a two-faced kind of attitude here, the public attitude, oh, we're going to be tough on you guys, and then the quiet attitude, we're not going to be so tough on you guys, going on. Okay. Let's move to Argentina, and actually emerging markets in general again. Okay, what's happening in Argentina, and how is Argentina the canary in the emerging markets coal mine here? Because it's not just Argentina. The other soft spot not getting as much attention is Turkey. Maybe we'll mention something about that, right? Once again, the problem in Argentina is that it's raised its domestic interest rates. The central bank has raised its interest rates to 40%. 40%. Whoa. I mean, that's going to shut down all its domestic industries that have to borrow money to stay in business, right? It's going to be mass layoffs. 40%. Well, why would a government do that? Well, this Macri government is just a corporate finance government that slipped in here in the last elections using the tactic that has been used throughout Latin America to push business and U.S. interests to take over the governments that were, a little bit social democratic. And that tactic is, oh, corruption, corruption, big corruption claims and so forth against the existing governments, and using that corruption and the courts, and to some extent, if they can, the legislatures, right, to throw out the governments and then have elections when everyone thinks corruption is the main issue. And thereby slip in and take control of the governments again. Well, that happened with Macri here a couple years ago, where he pushed aside the Kirchner government. That happened in Brazil, where Rousseff and the Rousseff Workers' Party, which was running the show, Lula's party, were charged with corruption here with regard to campaign finances and the oil company. Of course, the offensive against Venezuela is runs along the same lines here, corruption, corruption. Of course, Venezuela, the U.S. has done everything it can to wreck that economy and by wrecking its currency, which it did. Okay, so, the whole U.S. capitalist domestic corp business in those country interests here used the corruption tactic to get themselves in. But as soon as they got themselves in, they started ripping off the economy. Argentina, first thing Macri did when he came in was to say, we're going to pay the hedge fund guys billions of dollars. The hedge fund people had exploited Argentina in its crisis back in 2002, and the Kirchner government refused to pay all the demands by the hedge funds, vulture capitalists, whatever. And that fight went on for years and years, and they refused to pay them the billions they were demanding. The hedge funds, U.S. hedge funds, by the way, were demanding. But as soon as Macri comes in, says, we're going to pay the hedge fund guys. Why? Because then as soon as they paid them, they would get more loans, you see, for themselves, that they would make big money off of, skim off the top, the investors. So that was 2 years ago. So the same game that caused and ran up to the 2002-03 crisis in Argentina was quickly played again here in the last 2 years. And part of that game was borrowing in dollars, you see. Argentina began borrowing in dollars, dollar-denominated debt, bonds, both government and non-government bonds here. If you borrow in dollars, you're going to borrow from U.S. bankers and shadow bankers, and they're going to make all the money, see? That was probably part of the deal here. Okay, so Argentina is up to its ears in dollar-denominated debt. Dollar-denominated debt, which means it's got to pay that debt in dollars. Which means when the price of dollars goes up, when the dollar appreciates because the U.S. Fed's raising interest rate, right? It's got to pay more, and it's got to pay it in dollars. You see, the debt, the cost of the debt incurred rises, and it's got to be paid in dollars because it's dollar-denominated debt. Well, how much dollars? Foreign currency does Argentina have in dollars? And if it keeps paying it out, it's going to run out of it. And if it runs out of dollars, what's it going to do when it wants to buy imports with dollars? Well, it's not going to have any dollars, you see. If it doesn't have any dollars to fund their export-import trade, it's going to then have to go to the IMF and say, can we borrow some dollars from you, IMF? And then they just get more in debt to the IMF. Look, Argentina is the same thing as Greece writ large. It's the same phenomenon of exploitation through finance. In my book, Looting Greece, A New Financial Imperialism Emerges, 2016, the last chapter, I talk about financial imperialism. Financial imperialism. By the way, you can read an excerpt of that on my blog, jackrasmus.com. Okay, so it's really Greece writ large. And since it has to pay in dollars and the value of the dollar is rising, it means that the value of their peso, Argentine peso, is devaluating, is declining. So it costs more in dollars and you got to use more pesos to buy your dollars. That's a crisis that has no end. So when your currency, the peso, is devaluing, your investors and businesses and corporations do not want to hold pesos because their profits are being undermined, are being cut by the amount of the devaluation. They want to sell pesos and buy the currency that's rising, which is the dollar, before the exchange becomes too wide, and they can't afford to use pesos to buy dollars. They want to get out of pesos that are falling in value and get into dollars that are rising in value. Well, what that means is that you've got investors in Argentina who are sending the money out of the country to buy dollars in global dollar markets. Now, if you're selling your pesos, you're going to drive down the value of the pesos even more on top of it all, and drive up the value of the dollar even more on top of it all. So you see, it's sort of a vicious cycle here. As a devaluation occurs, actions to get out of pesos causes the devaluation to become even worse. Okay, capital flight is what we're talking about here. Well, to stop the capital flight, the Argentine Central Bank raises interest rates to 40%. In other words, they're saying, put your pesos here in government bonds and so forth at 40% instead of sending it out and putting it into dollars, buying dollars offshore. Well, but by raising the interest rate to 40%, they're shutting off the real economy there. But they don't care. They just want to protect the profits and the value of the investments of their investor class, They don't care what really happens to the real economy and the working class. They're going to pay for it. And this devaluation not only slows down the real economy because rates rise, it also raises inflation significantly, especially in a country like Argentina, where so much of goods are imported. If your currency declines, the cost of your imports go up. So what you get is runaway inflation as well as a slowing economy. We call that stagflation, you see. And that's what's happening. It's devastating for working class and middle class, right? But it protects, the whole thing protects the value of the investments of the wealthy. And that's all Macri wants to do right now. And in the meantime, get some money from the IMF to try to slow the whole process down. That's what's happening in Argentina, right? The peso, by the way, has declined, right, from 16 to 23. In other words, over the course of less than a year, by 40%, 40%. Significant. Right? But now this is happening not just with Argentina. Argentina, by the way, has gone to the IMF and said, please give us a $40 billion bailout, right? Because we have no, we're running out of currency here, dollars, which means we won't be able to import anything, right? And what that means is same thing as Venezuela. Venezuela ran out of dollars. They couldn't import anything. At the same time, the value of oil collapsed, so they couldn't generate government revenues. 95% of all government revenue comes from oil in Argentina. So Argentina got hit from both directions. But there's a similarity here, you see. The collapse of the currency raised the cost of all these imports, including medical and so forth, in Venezuela. Well, the same thing's happening due to the capitalists. economy in Argentina, and due to the fact that Argentina got in too much debt once again quickly, and it's a dollarized debt in recent years under Macri. Okay, since April 2nd alone, the Argentine peso has declined 10%. Since January, 20%, and more than that. If you look over, since the middle of last year, How about the Mexican peso? That's declined in the last month by 5%. Brazilian real, 6%. Turkish lira, 7% in 1 month. In 1 month. In other words, there's a emerging market crisis brewing with devaluations occurring everywhere at different rates and speeds. And central banks in those countries raising rates, interest rates at different rates and speeds, and all those economies are going to dramatically slow down, not only because of the rate hikes, but also because of rising import inflation. Turkey is almost as bad off as Argentina. You don't hear as much because Argentina is getting the attention, right? But Turkey also did the same thing, borrowed heavily in dollars, right? Foreign currency denominated debt, mostly dollars, right, hit 69% of GDP last year, up from 39% in 2009. Brazil is 51%. Well, Turkey is even more of its debt denominated in dollars and in euros. Okay, so that's apparently we run out of time, but that's what's happening in emerging markets. Crisis coming, and we will follow that closely.